Welcome to the From the Vine podcast. I'm your host, Bob Heifel, a reporter and writer of the From the Vine wine column for The Record in Stockton, California. I'm certified level 3 with the Wine and Spirit Education Trust and a part-time tasting room associate at the Lodi Wine and Visitor Center. I hope you enjoy this podcast, which focuses on the Lodi American Viticultural Area. I welcome your comments and reviews on our Facebook group page at recordnet.com/FTV209. And you can follow us at FTV209 on Twitter and Instagram. Welcome to the From the Vine podcast, the show that highlights the great growers and winemakers of the Lodi Appellation. And it is my pleasure to have a great grower and winemaker with us, David Lucas of the Lucas Winery here in Lodi. And we're actually taping this podcast from his beautiful winery here on Davis Road. We are actually behind the main building in an area that his daughter Mitra Lucas Grant has set up for wine club members. I wish you could see this. We're surrounded by these beautiful vineyards. We're underneath some gorgeous trees with a nice umbrella on a warm morning. The Zinstar Vineyard is right next to us. So, David, welcome, and it is such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. You may find out that this is really a bad idea, but let's try it out.
We'll try it anyway. That's the great thing about editing, which we can do. So, no, it really is a pleasure. And I've been so fortunate to kind of get to know this wine community and really appreciate the people that are behind it. And may I just say that your friendship and my association with you, I'm so proud of, and just really, really appreciate all the kindness you've shown me over the years, and today is no exception. So thank you for everything.
Well, thank you. You're the last one that would say that, but thank you for the comment.
I first met you, actually, you probably don't remember meeting me. I remember meeting you, but I came here to taste several years ago, and you were doing kind of a private barrel tasting in your Grand Chai, which you do from time to time. Right. But that's how I kind of took to this experience in this winery, and it really is, when you come here, a customer experience that is quite unique and quite unlike any other. And can you kind of describe what you kind of had in mind for the customers when they came to your winery?
Well, people have so many questions about wine and grape growing, and should I serve this with a bologna sandwich, or, you know, I've got this really expensive $3.99 bottle of wine, what's the perfect tuna to go with that? So, you know, with those questions, we really try to create an environment that people will feel free to open up and ask all of the questions that they have. So we start with an introduction about the winery and the winemaking, and then we go out to the vineyard, where there's always something exciting going on. Right now, for instance, the Zinstar Vineyard is just beginning to go through veraison, when the grapes are going from green to black, and it's also organically certified, so people like hearing about how we control with predators a bug, some of the bad bugs that will attack the vineyard. And then from there, we go into the Grand Chai, or the barrel room, which is very unique, something that I fell in love with, the way of clarifying, cleansing the wines, stabilizing the wines, that comes from Europe, which is basically where I met my wife, Heather. But we decided to do the Grand Chai concept, where the barrels are single high, which allows when the wine first goes in the barrel, it has a little bit of yeast and skins in it. It's not very clear. And over time, you know, 60, 100, 2,000 years ago, that was the only way they could get the wine clear, because they didn't have the industrial process of making wine, running it through pumps and filters. So they would just let those things settle down to the bottom of the barrel and then pump the clear wine off of the top, rinse the barrel out, and bring the wine back to the barrel. And in trials that I was exposed to during part of my journey with the Opus project, particularly on the vineyard side, We did some trials at Mondavi, and the preference was really for wines that were barrel-aged and had that extended skin contact. And we applied the same thing to our Chardonnay, where the Chardonnay will finish fermentation, the yeast will settle down at the bottom of the barrel. And again, this is a European technique, mm-hmm. and these people in Europe have been at it for a really long time. So what we'll do then is every couple of days I'll go in after those yeast leaves settle down and the wine is pretty clear, and I'll stir that up and it turns really milky. And what we find out is you make wines that have more character, more personality, as well as they're longer lived.
Uh-huh.
So for instance, with our Chardonnay, Heather's goal is to craft a Chardonnay that'll age 8 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, and I had the opportunity to taste some of your library Chardonnay, and the complexity and the differences and the evolution of some of the earlier vintages. I think 2001 might have been the oldest vintage I've tried. Are remarkable.
Yeah, 79 I think was the first
one. Is that right?
Heather convinced me we should do a white wine here at the winery, and she picked Chardonnay, and I said, yeah, but you know the world thinks Lodi is really hot, which uh-huh. is another mistake people make.
Yeah.
About Lodi, but we made the first Chardonnays and found two really great vineyards. She actually went out, which is the reason people hire her around the world. They want to make vineyard designated wines, and she went out tasting Chardonnays right when the growers were picking, and she found two growers that she thought their vineyards were really remarkable in the flavors. One has more pippin apple, citrus lemon lime. The other one tends to be more tropical, if you would, golden, ripe golden delicious. So, plus she got two growers that would work with her.
Uh-huh.
I'm married to her, right. And I don't do that. So I don't do it well at all.
You want to stay on her good side, right?
So anyway, she got these two growers to do everything she wanted in the vineyard. We did some really, really remarkably unique things. We did Varesian thinning in Chardonnay. I mean, how do you do that since they don't change color, right?
Uh-huh.
That's a whole other story. And brought them in, barrel fermented and brand new French oak. Left them on the yeast lees, as I mentioned before. Bottled it and waited a couple of years and released the first vintage, and it's just been a hit ever since.
Yeah. So the Zinstar Vineyard is directly behind the main building here.
Right.
And that's a vineyard that's really kind of what I think this winery is centered on, don't you?
Yeah, definitely a unique vineyard. I actually didn't think very much of that vineyard 40 years ago. Because back in those days, you know, I was making what I call award-winning judges wines, Zinfandels, you know, which are over 15% alcohol, have a little bit of residual sugar to mask the alcohol, and really the best food pairing is probably peanut butter because they're so bloody jammy, you know, and they still win awards. Uh-huh. I mean, they really win because if you're a judge, your palate fatigues.
Yeah.
If I'm looking for a really beautiful, say, and my benchmark for Sauvignon Blanc is the Loire Valley in France.
Uh-huh.
And the one in a judging, if I'm tasting 16 Sauvignon Blancs, is something from New Zealand, very asparagusy and whatnot. And the next one is from Loire or from Lodi.
Mm-hmm.
It gets completely, your palate just goes stupid
uh-huh.
tasting those wines, you know? So anyway, this little vineyard, I was with Tim Mondavi. We were in Burgundy. Tim was trying to figure out how to make a world-class California Pinot Noir,
mm-hmm.
which is a great challenge
uh-huh.
because we still don't necessarily, although we are probably further down the road now than we were, there are so many selections of Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
And some other wineries like the Gallows have done some remarkable work finding a selection that'll do well here in Lodi.
Uh-huh.
And so in tasting those with Tim, I just went, oh, so this is what wine is really like, wine and food, you know, those beautiful Pinots. And I was not a fan of California Pinots.
Uh-huh.
And came back, and since I was buying small lots of Zinfandel throughout Lodi from different vineyards and had the wonderful experience of being with Mondavi Woodbridge, where we kept every Zin grower's wine separate, had a real opportunity to see the profile of Lodi Zinfandels. And then this little vineyard that we call Zinstar, just under 4 acres, has really come to the forefront. Mm. And so she's organically certified,
uh-huh.
and I've been working with her for 30 years. And so we have a pretty good working relationship now.
Right. You know this vineyard inside and out.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I can take you to any spot in that vineyard and tell you, this is Susie and Cindy and Madeline, and this is, they'll ripen a little bit further quickly than you know, Caroline and Debbie and, yep.
All girls' names, you wolf.
Yeah, yeah, you got to stick in and got to go where it is.
You know, the old vine Zinfandel, which Zinstar certainly would qualify under that nebulous kind of moniker, description, label. Are there certain aspects of a vineyard in Zinstar's age frame that make the wines special?
Part of it is they have very low vigor, but they still would, in many years, like to produce a high vigor crop. So for Zinstar, we try to keep her at around 2.5-3 tons of the acre, which of course is not economically viable for growers. If you're a grower growing Zinfandel today, if you can find a home for it, and you're getting $500 a ton, 3 tons to the acre, that's $1,500. It costs you $3,000 a ton. You know, your banker will point out very quickly,
hey,
this is really a bad idea.
This is not going to work.
So the old vine Zins, produce almost by themselves a really high quality Zinfandel. You can do the same thing, not to dispel the myth, but I will, with a young Zinfandel vineyard, but you just have to farm it differently. So one of the tricks that we do with Zinfandel, because you have a little bit of that uneven ripening, which is sort of a misstatement about Zinfandels, because almost every grape variety does the same thing.
Yeah,
Zins are very, very noticeable.
Uh-huh.
We will go through during veraison, as I mentioned, that's where Zinstar is right now, and most Zins in Lodi are just into that color regime, where they're going from green to black. We will go through when we think it's time and cut out any clusters that are 50% green or more. And you go back out the next morning and you look in the vine and everything looks ripe.
Uh-huh.
You just don't want to look on the ground. Because it's half the crop. It's at least half the crop.
Right.
But that single activity in the vineyard is more important than anything we do in the winery in terms of winemaking.
Right.
Because winemaking is mostly about sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
So as Heather says, if she can get really healthy, sound grapes coming in from the vineyard, nice acids and pHs and very clean, then her job is really just babysitting.
I see.
Everything else will take care of itself.
Right. So does Zinstar get oak?
It gets French oak from 4 or 5 different French coopers. Over the years, I've probably looked at probably 20 different barrel makers, and I've selected 5 that I think really go well with the Zinstar vineyard. One of my trick questions when I used to consult, And a young winemaker, old winemaker, he takes some wine out of barrels, and I go, so how come you have these barrels? And he goes, well, my grandmother's grandfather had these barrels, and we found them in a cellar, and so we used them. Mm-hmm. I never got the answer that I was looking for, which was, well, I've tried 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 different barrel makers, and these are the best for my vineyard. So barrel selection, especially with Zins and Pinot, is really almost vineyard specific, if you will.
Right.
So I remember one time a guy brought in some Zinfandel, and I smelled it, and I go, so what did you ferment this in? He said, well, I went down to the hardware store and I got some plastic tubs and I fermented in that. And I said, and what did those smell like?
Because that's what the wine smells like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So the selection of oak is really, really critical. And if you like cooking, with spices and whatnot, the barrel selection lights your fire.
Right. Well, in that kind of the winemaker's spice rack is oak.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit. Where are you from, David? Where were you born?
Southern California, beaches of Southern California. Was a junior lifeguard in Santa Monica, which allowed me to stay at the senior lifeguard station, which was surrounded by girls.
Have any of those girls you named your vines after? Are there any connections there?
There probably are. Ricky Gregg was my lifeguard captain, very famous big wave rider.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me into paddling around in the ocean and falling off my surfboard.
And doing some surfing.
Yeah.
How good did you get surfing?
How good did I get?
Yeah, did you enter any, you know, were you a competitive surfer?
No. Competitive surfing is, well, I mean, it just wasn't possible. I mean, you couldn't make a living. I actually started a surf shop in Southern California. You couldn't make a living at it back then. You know, but if I had started it shaping my own Lucas surfboards back then, who knows? I mean, you know, some boards now are going for $2,000.
That's crazy.
Which is way beyond what I could have afforded picking up aluminum cans on the streets of Santa Monica. So, you know, but, you know, a really good board today is going to be $500 if you can find it on sale to $1,500.
Yeah.
And they break real easy. We had old balsa boards.
Oh, so those broke.
Yeah, the foam boards, the new foam boards, really.
Right. You've surfed all over the place. Where's your favorite place to go?
Probably Saladita, Mexico. So we fly into Zihuatanejo, rent a car, put the boards on top, drive north for about 2 hours to this place and hang on the beach, and it's a beautiful old man wave. Just, you know, it's just a nice rolly, like Malibu, left-hander. So, yeah, it's just really great, and some of the best chili rellenos in all of Mexico, and I can vouch for that.
I couldn't surf, but I could certainly watch you surf and eat some chili rellenos at the same time. Well, you said left-hander. What does that mean for a non-surfing person?
So that means some people call it goofy foot, but I call it true foot. So it's the way you face the wave. So if the wave is breaking off your left shoulder, that would be a left-hander. Okay. And when you stand up, you face the wave, so your back is to the beach, which for right-handers is kind of not very natural, you know.
Right.
So it's my preferred way to go.
All right. I'm going to get deep with you here, probably a really silly question. Is there any comparison to riding a great wave or having a great time in the ocean, that artistry? Because there is artistry to that. And the artistry of being a grower and a winemaker.
I think it's philosophical.
Yeah.
You know, I just enjoy getting up in the morning if I'm at the beach and punching through the first wave before the sun comes up. And the same thing with the vineyard. I enjoy getting up in the morning and just walking out through the vineyard. You know, there's no white noise here in Lodi. Unless the train's going by or something, which is miles away. But there's, I mean, listen now.
Yeah. Just hear the leaves rustling, an occasional car going by, but mostly it's just peace and quiet and just that tranquil. God, it's so relaxing.
Yeah. So it's just...
It's like it's speaking to you a little bit.
Yeah, it's just you're out here in this and you're getting you're watching things grow and remembering that the vines have the same molecular structure that we do. Okay. I mean, people forget that.
Yeah.
But the same, it's just our brains took us this way and their brains took them that way.
I see.
But we meet at the table.
Right.
That's philosophical.
Totally. Got me thinking. We're higher on the food chain, so I guess we get to enjoy them by ingesting them.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Ooh. So long as Mother Nature works with you. In 2015, you know, we had that hailstorm come through.
That's
here.
That's right.
And we lost everything.
Wow.
It looked like, you know, what was it, the Mormons and the seagulls? Yeah, the seagulls didn't show up, but the vines just looked like they had, all the leaves were off.
Wow.
It was really a tragedy. That's why next time I'm coming back as a banker. I'm not going to come back as a dirt farmer. I'm really going to come
back. You're going to evolve higher on the corporate food chain and be a banker.
And as you know, our brains today are completely different than 4,000 years ago. It's because they keep evolving.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the vines. We're still learning so much about what to do in the vineyards to influence wine quality.
Right.
Because it has to start in the vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
It has to start in the vineyard. But you have to be paid enough to make that work as a grower.
Yeah.
And that's the big challenge for growers today.
I was going to ask you about that at some point here, but that is the challenge, especially in the Zinfandel market.
Yeah. Oh, the Zinfandel market is, this will be the, I don't know, you know, I'm back from when the world was cold, okay? So I've been through probably five different cycles in grapes, and Zins are really at the bottom right now.
As far as marketability, pricing.
Pricing.
Right.
We've just been planting a lot of grapes all over California. Mm-hmm. And so those start to show up. And the newer vineyards are being planted at higher densities. Most of the old Zin vineyards were 10 feet by 10 feet. Mm-hmm. Now that we're seeing vineyards planted by 6 feet by 6 feet, so you have more vines, you have more tons yield, more tons per acre.
So is that 6 vines per 6 feet? Is that what 6 by 6, 10 by 10 mean?
No, they're spaced 6 feet apart.
I see.
Versus 10 feet apart.
Okay.
So, you know, and in Europe, they're meter by meter. Mm-hmm. They're 3 feet in the row and 3 feet between the vines. And that evolved because they use horses.
I see.
Our system evolved because we were going from grain farming to deciding to plant vineyards. And so we wanted our tractors that we already had from our other crops to fit down the vine row. Uh-huh. Without any consideration that vine spacing had any influence on wine quality. Mm. I was with Alan Carbonneau's research program in Bordeaux. Alan Carbonneau is probably one of the top 5 viticulturists in the world. He has Cabernet, for instance, planted on every rootstock known to mankind, on every clone known to mankind, on every spacing you can think of. And he has his own little winery. So he makes wines out of all of those. And you sit down with him and he says, would you like to taste meter by meter? So the vines are 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet high. They'd look gorgeous in your room. Yeah, that'd be cool. You want to taste what he calls the California sprawl, which is where we have the machine harvesting set up and you have the canopy coming over on top of the vine, and the difference is day and night. But then he says, now let me take the traditional meter by meter in France and spread that spacing out a little bit and create a higher vertical panel instead of 3 feet to 6 feet, and the wine quality is remarkably different and improved. So when we planted the Opus vineyard, we did that. We went with a higher canopy. So it's just all of these little aspects that make such a difference.
Right. These little tiny little, well, that seem tiny maybe to a layperson like myself, but are actually huge in the results. You've brought up Opus a couple times. You worked for Robert Mondavi, the Woodbridge Winery. Your wife Heather was very involved in the Opus One project, that great collaboration between Mondavi and
Mouton.
Yeah. Tell us about that experience, if you would.
About meeting Heather?
Well, we could. Yeah, absolutely. Well, if she listens to this, yes. Yes, let's talk about you meeting Heather.
So I was responsible for Mondavi's California grape and joint ventures, as well as their grower relations. Uh-huh. And when we were putting together the joint venture between Mouton and Mondavi, Heather, because she's French trained and speaks French, she was asked to be the liaison between the California and the French winemakers, which was an incredible journey. So one day, Heather asked me, she knew that I did a lot of bike riding, she asked me if I wanted to go on a bike ride, and I said, yeah, sure. She says, well, meet me at Yountville at the park and we'll go for a pedal. And so we started off down the Silverado Trail, heading towards Napa, and has a nice wide bike path there. And I pedaled up alongside her, and I said, so Heather, do you do very much bike riding? I was doing a lot of bike riding. I mean, I was doing hundreds and hundreds of miles. And she says, yeah, last weekend I did a century, that's 100 miles, and tomorrow I'm doing a double century, which is 200 miles.
Wow.
I stopped the bike, turned around, and headed back to Yountville.
There's no way you were going to keep up with her?
No way. But the thing about Heather, and I maybe can count the winemakers on fingers and toes, is that she's one of the few that understands the viticultural practices and how those influence wine quality. Mm. If she's working with a winery, she will be out in the vineyards once a month throughout the year. And then once it gets close to harvest, she'll be out there on a daily basis. So she really truly understands irrigation decisions, leaf removal, veraison thinning, all of these aspects that go into creating world-class wines. And she has and I'm not saying this because she's my wife, I'm saying this because it's the reason I married her. She has an incredible palate for balance. She really understands balance. And so she's not a fan of too much oak or overripe fruit or underripe fruit. It's been a remarkable journey working with her.
Fantastic.
If I'd only do what she asked me to do.
That makes it go much smoother. So we're with David Lucas of the Lucas Winery talking about his remarkable life. We know you're from Southern California. How did you get to Lodi?
Well, I was in the Foreign Service with the embassy in India for 3 years and Iran for 3 years. And came back and was offered a position with the company that I'd worked for before I left when I was in college to take care of the grower relations in the Delta, and mostly asparagus, which was like watching grass grow. Really boring crop.
Boring.
Asparagus, pears, and tomatoes out in the Delta. And then bought this vineyard. Because no other grower would touch it. It was so run down and exhausted.
The Zinsser Vineyard?
The whole 30 acres.
30 acres, okay, yeah.
So, bought the vineyard, started making wine, and then met Mike Phillips and Steve Bora. Steve Bora, who is the monumental, historic winemaker in Lodi and is dealing with his own personal battle right now. I mean, it's just remarkable individual. So anyway, Mike Phillips came over one day and said, because we were both making home wine, this was before we got busted by the feds, and said, hey, there's a guy down on Armstrong Road making wine. We should go visit him. He has a small winery. Uh-huh. So somebody was already in the business, right?
And that was Steve.
That was Steve Bora. Uh-huh. So we went down there, went down to his cellar, which was underneath his house at the time, is now his office, and started tasting his Barberas. Man, I mean, I still wish I could get a hold of those Barberas.
Wow.
Just magical. And that was his claim to fame. And then I started my winery in 78, and I think Mike got his going in 82 or 84, He and David. And everybody went, really silly idea. I mean, how are you going to compete against the big wineries, which is what Lodi had,
right.
Large wineries?
Yeah, give us an idea of what the scene was like here as far as wineries. It was just the big boys, right?
It was just big. Mm-hmm. And they still buy most of the grapes.
Right.
But the smaller wineries, of which, you know, now there's, 96 or 97?
Something like that, yeah.
Are starting to push the price up a little bit. Uh-huh. We pay top dollar to our Chardonnay growers.
Yeah.
Or if we're going to do a Pinot Noir or whatever, we pay way above the market because of what we expect for them to do in the vineyard. But, a story I like to tell is when I used to have to be out in the market, now everything is our subscribers. Uh-huh. We're not in restaurants or supermarkets anymore at all, which was my daughter's Mitra's a change. So in the early days, I mean, you had to go out and walk the streets, Carmel, Santa Barbara. In Carmel, bumped into Fred Dame.
Oh, wow.
And he helped us get into Restaurant Central and the Sardine Factory. But you had to be out on the streets. So, I don't know, years and years ago, I was up in Sacramento, barefoot with my bag of wine samples and walking through 10 feet of snow. And I came out of this restaurant, and Steve was just coming back into the restaurant, and I said, don't bother to go in there. He said, well, why not? I said, well, because the guy really liked the wine, but why did we have to put Lodi on the label? Mm-hmm. So I turned to Steve, and I said, so how many bottles of wine do you have open in your sample kit? And he said, well, I've got 4. And I said, well, I've got 3. Let's go to lunch. So we went to lunch, drank all 7 bottles of wine, swear to God. Well, they weren't completely full.
No, no.
But we got up, got out, walked out, and all the snow was gone. But that's the battle that it took.
Yeah, right.
I mean, getting into Raley's was just pulling hair. You know, it was unbelievably challenging back then.
So but what year are we talking about?
We're talking about 79,
okay.
80, 81,
you were just 82. Starting. You were just starting to sell your
just
wine.
Just starting, yeah. We were legally bonded in 78.
Okay.
But I started making wine my first year that we bought the vineyard, which was probably in 72.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. So the Lodi name on the label was a tough sell, and I guess it is still to a degree. Is it getting? Is it easier now?
It's magical now.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a sign out in front now that you need a reservation. We staff 5 to 6 people.
Yeah.
Because of the experience we want people to have it's unbelievable. Lodi is magical. It's just on fire right now. People know how to say it.
Right. Not okay. Lodi.
Lodi. And they really love the vineyard experience, especially when we talk about organic and what it takes to farm organically. They get to come out to see the vineyard. And of course, one of my little hidden agendas is that these people are going to go home, and I want them to understand agriculture and farming, because they're going to vote.
Mm.
And the more they understand about us,
right,
then our side of the challenges that we go through as farmers, then, we have more people that are ambassadors for farming.
And Mark Chandler brought this up when we did the podcast with him. He's the, for those of you who don't know or didn't listen to that podcast, Mark is the current mayor of Lodi. His second stint is mayor of Lodi, but he's also a grape grower and former executive director of the Lodi Wine Grape Commission, actually helped form that body and was instrumental in the marketing efforts behind what David is talking about as far as the recognition of Lodi. But he said, when you bring in people from outside to visit here and meet, people like you and touch the soil and taste the wines, the conversion rate, because many of them are more than skeptical when they come here based on their preconceived notions. He said it's close to, if not a 100% conversion rate. They always leave going out and then telling others about what a great place this is.
Yeah, it's, people cast us into the Central Valley, and it's just one degree cooler than Death Valley.
Right.
But if you live here in Lodi, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So we get that beautiful marine influence through the bay, through the Cartina Straits. In the evening, the temperature drops down here into the 50s, and certainly in the midday it can get hot. This year has been really remarkably cool, so that brings a bunch of different problems if you're a grape grower.
Uh-huh.
But so far, in terms of ripening temperatures, it's been just beautiful. But it's just that concept that it's really hot, but people come over here, and in the evening time, if you're having a barbie, you'll see people putting on light jackets and whatnot.
Right.
It just cools down so nicely,
mm-hmm.
which is the reason originally, years ago, we could grow the Flame Tokay here. Because the Flame Tokay only has one coloring pigment, whereas red grapes have three. And you needed that exchange between the warm days and the cool nights to trigger that beautiful flame color here.
Ah.
You couldn't do that in Sacramento, you couldn't do it in Bakersfield.
Right.
And so that was Lodi's claim to fame. And then, of course, somebody came out with a flame-colored grape that didn't have seeds, and that ended that market real quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, your daughter, Mitra Grant, who lives in New York with her family, her husband and family, has taken on kind of the operations role here at the Lucas Winery.
Yes.
I'm sure you were ready for that to happen, but was it at all difficult to kind of give up the reins? You know who Mitra is.
Get me out of here really quick. I have no problem with letting go. In fact, I can be downright lazy. So, and when I retired from Mondavi, I actually did some consulting for families that were going through that transition.
Uh-huh.
And you got the sons and the daughters and the dad sitting at the table, and the dad would always interrupt. And, I just tell Mitra, well, I know what's right, but I don't interrupt. But she has done all of it. I mean, her background is she set up the charter schools for the city of New York. So she understands managing people. She had to deal with unions,
right,
union organizers, and she's highly organized. But on top of that, she's pruned. She's irrigated out here when we used to do furrow irrigation,
uh-huh,
when it was, 100 degrees and the soil and it was burning her feet. she'd be out there with the shovel and with me side by side irrigating. And she'd turn to me and she'd say, "You know, Dad, I'm really glad I get to do this in this hot, dusty irrigation that we're doing right now, rather than go with my friends to Santa Cruz. I'm such a lucky girl." So anyway, she's done it all. Wow. She's cleaned tanks. Uh-huh. She's pressed wine. So she has a real history. She's been with me, with Heather and I, to Europe, visiting the great chateaus and producers, and tasting those wines and seeing how those wines were presented and how those wines were crafted beginning in the vineyard. Mm-hmm. So she has a really good global perspective.
Yeah. There's more family involved in this great place.
Yeah, there's aunts and uncles, as well as, in the early days, we'd invite people over to friends and do a barbecue to help us prune, because we could not afford to do it all ourselves. And for the first couple of years, we pruned these old vines, this 30 acres, all by ourselves, our friends from Iran, and also my son Buck, who has done all of it. You know, he's done the pressing. He has a really, really good palate, and he's responsible for our second label of Zinfandel Citizen, which was the wine that he developed, and it's CTZN. It's a wine he developed. He wanted it to be, they're making a more early drinking style. Uh-huh. And he was going to distribute it just to independently owned restaurants in the Bay Area. And one of the challenges, of course, is somebody in the restaurant business invented the chalkboard. In the old days, you had the printed wine list, and so you were on that list, right? Uh-huh. And they weren't going to be reprinting it every week.
Right.
With a chalkboard,
you could erase it.
You can erase it. And so he'd go back 2 weeks later, and the guy would say, "No, it was a hit. We're sold out. Well, you want some more? No, we have somebody else on the chalkboard."
Oh, geez.
Now. Yeah. So we brought it to the winery, and it's just been a hit. We released that wine, and it's gone.
Wow.
I mean, it's just remarkable.
Right.
And so Buck has a really good background in ag business. He went to school at Cal Poly, San Luis, where I went to school, and my dad went to school as well. My dad did aeronautical engineering and was involved in the SR-71 Blackbird.
Wow.
Designed that airplane, but also came from a farm background, and where they grew oranges in Visalia. But and he grew walnuts down in the San Fernando Valley before we grew houses. But Buck, with his own marketing background, has been very helpful, I think, in particular with Mitra, in the direction that the winery should go.
Is Buck in Lodi, or is he live elsewhere?
Buck is in San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Okay. He consults businesses that are either close to bankruptcy or in bankruptcy. He helps to restructure their business. He's a turnaround guy.
Uh-huh.
So, which drives him to drink.
Which drives him to make wine.
Right. So, yeah, he's done it all, as I said. He's done the irrigating, the pruning, the pressing. But right now he's based in San Francisco.
And is he still involved with the Citizen wine? Is that still his baby?
He's involved in it from the standpoint of drinking it.
I see. Good
but,
for him.
But he's so busy with his other projects.
Yeah.
But it's been a real success story for the winery.
So is that part of Heather? Does she make it now, or has made it for a while?
She makes it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So she made it from the beginning with what Buck's goals and objective were standpoint of a wine
of
style.
Of a wine style, okay.
So
it's lighter in color. It's
not necessarily. It's it's just more approachable. Zinstar really needs 5, 10, 25, 30 years.
I see.
But people don't want to do that, really. Uh-huh. You know, they want to bottle aging for a lot of people is from the time they buy it at the supermarket until they screw the lid off that evening. You know, that's the bottle aging. And we have the technology in wineries today to make wines very drinkable very quickly. Okay. 60, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, we didn't have that ability. Uh-huh. Red wines definitely had to have some age on them. But you don't see a lot of houses being built today with wine cellars.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Swimming pools.
Swimming pools. But, movie stars.
Right.
The Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah. So, it's been a great journey for this family.
Do you think you brought or helped bring European winemaking techniques to Lodi? Kind of at the beginning?
In the beginning, it was kind of, well, we don't need that European stuff.
Right. We're yeah. loud and proud, and we're low.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
But how much are you getting for your grapes? And we still have a little bit of that out there in the neighborhood where people go, well, you know, nobody's going to pay $50 for a Lodi Zinfandel.
Right.
But it's starting to happen. Uh-huh. Steve Bora said in his lifetime he wanted to see a Zinfandel or any wine in Lodi at $100. That was his goal and his objective. And people kind of go, well, yeah, but I'm not going to pay more than $19.95 for a Lodi wine.
Yeah.
Well, how much do you want to get paid for your grapes?
Right.
You know?
The prices have to, you know,
there's a pass-through there.
Yeah, right.
So if you're talking down the wine, you're talking down your vineyards.
Right, yeah.
And oak barrels today, I'm paying $1,300 a piece for French oak barrels.
For brand new, yeah.
Yeah. You can get a lot of oak sawdust and a lot of oak chips for that same amount of money. But the difference is day and night between both of those. And so that really influences the cost of your bottle of wine. You start putting that cost of goods against a bottle, and it's tough. It's tough to break even at $20 a bottle.
Yeah.
If you're doing everything that's necessary in the vineyards, and in the winery, and in the winemaking, you know.
Yeah. So, to get your hands on some Lucas Winery Zinstar Zinfandel, and you'd be very fortunate to do so, you need to go on lucaswinery.com, or better yet, come to this beautiful place on Davis Road, just north of Turner Road in Lodi, and make a day of Lodi wine country. But make sure you stop by the Lucas Winery here. Taste the wines. If you're fortunate, meet David. And you can always, always see these beautiful grounds and touch and walk amongst one of the great vineyards here in Lodi, the Zinstar Vineyard. So, a remarkable experience, so please come on out and just enjoy enjoy Lodi.
Lodi has the world's largest acreage of old head prune zins, even more than Bari, Italy, where it's called Primitivo. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to see here. And if you're coming here, you know, the streets are wide open, beautiful country drives in your Jag X-Key, you know, or your Maserati, or you're an old 1944.
You're a car guy.
Yeah, yeah. I have a few tents. But you definitely want to, you know, spend a night or two nights at a minimum.
Yeah.
Fantastic restaurants downtown.
Yes.
And just enjoy what's going on here. It's very personal. Any winery you stop at is going to knock your socks off. So
that 100% conversion rate goes for customers and wine enthusiasts, not just journalists.
Yeah.
Absolutely. David, it's always a pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Well, I'm not done.
Oh, you're not? What else do you have to say? Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we do this again?
Okay.
And we could talk about what we didn't touch on, and we could probably fill five or six of these podcasts.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to brag about Lodi. It's truly magical what's going on here now.
Excellent. David Lucas has been our guest on the From the Vine podcast. Thank you so much for listening.